This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, it's a farm to a pharmacy for one North Dakota CBD company. But we are going to start today talking about healthy families and how we can support parents on this journey as part of an effort to keep kids out of foster care, or if they do end up in foster care, how best to support the kids from there. The unexpected closure of Lutheran Social Services rocked a number of people across the state, and they were running the Healthy Families program to provide that support to expecting and new parents. We're talking today with Missy Barranco. She is the executive director of Aspire ND, and that's USPIREND, which was formed to pick up where LSS left off. Missy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
How was this program run when it was under LSS?
The Healthy Families program started with Lutheran Social Services about 21 years ago up in the northeast part of North Dakota. One of our goals is to really make sure we reduce child abuse and neglect, and so reduce the need for foster care placement. We then expanded about 11 years ago into the Burley, Morton, Bismarck, Mandan area. Then about 3-4 years ago, we expanded more into Western North Dakota, and we kind of continue that expansion across the state.
When LSS unexpectedly closed, take us back to that moment. I imagine a little bit of fear, tears, and then action.
Absolutely. Probably a lot of surprise initially and belief that what was happening, because it was a very big surprise. In most types of circumstances like this, we kind of went into a moment of kind of freeze of, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? And I would be honest to say, you know, working in a nonprofit world has so much joy and you get so much back, but it's also a lot of work, right? And so I definitely, as a leader of the Healthy Families program and in the Lutheran Social Services organization, had a moment of, I think I'm just going to go do something totally different because there is a lot of stress around this. And now there's this stress. And I had that for probably about 24 hours and then realized, no, we can't let this go. We worked too hard to get to where we are. And we have too many families that we're working with that I couldn't even just imagine letting them know a few days later that we were done and it was all gone. And so we really quickly, I connected with a handful of people that just were my cheerleaders and said, we can do this, and immediately gathered a board. Literally, I think we had a from the day that LSS announced closing, probably 6 days later, we had a board created and filed for our 501c3 and some of those initial paperwork pieces that we needed to do.
That's fast.
Well, I think too, once we got to that point, it was easier almost in that process of really grieving the loss of this organization that we had all known to grow with and love, to have something to focus on. And so it was a lot of hard work, but I think that helped in the kind of that healing process of losing what we were losing. And because we were so focused on continuing the services.
And what kinds of changes, if any, are under how this program runs now with it being its own thing, Aspire ND, instead of under the umbrella of LSS?
So as far as the family's experience, there were no changes. So that was our big goal, is that we said we didn't want families to feel any of that kind of bump, that earthquake that we felt happening. We said we as staff and people doing kind of that behind the scenes work are definitely going to feel changes and have a lot of changes ahead. But we wanted to make sure families didn't feel that. And really, the families just had a couple new forms they needed to sign around confidentiality and things since we were with a new organization. But I feel really strongly that families did not feel any change. They kept their same staff. We didn't lose any staff. We kept families. And so their visits and their support and services just kept going as normal, even though we were struggling and working hard and had a lot of challenges in front of us. We wanted to make sure our goal with families didn't feel that.
Yeah, I want to talk about the growing pains now as you've been doing this on your own for the better part of a year, the advantages and disadvantages. So these disadvantages, of course, LSS was a very well-known name, had a lot of procedures, had some money-raising skills, that name recognition, and you had other people to collaborate with. What are some of the advantages of running it this way?
Well, there's definitely less processes, which is an advantage and a disadvantage, right? So sometimes decision making can be a little faster. Mm-hmm. And also, I think we were able to gain some just really community support and interest because people wanted to see the program going. And so gained some interest and support that may not have otherwise when you're under a large organization. Mm-hmm. That sometimes people say, oh, well, you have this big organization, so you don't necessarily need the extra support or extra, people volunteering or things like that. And so I think definitely going on our own, we felt that a little differently. Mm-hmm. Before there was definitely support for the organization as a whole with Lutheran Social Services, but maybe not so much did we feel it directly for Healthy Families. Not that we didn't feel the support, I should say, but just it's sure. So personal now, that mm-hmm. connection with the Healthy Families program. And I think going out on our own also gave a little more information out to people about the program. And because, again, it's the main program of Aspire ND that we rehomed initially. And so so that's been different also. Just kind of navigating that whole thing. That piece is we're all doing a lot of the work that maybe other people did before. So whether it be connecting with funders, connecting with the community, some of that was done by others at Lutheran Social Services as a large agency where now we're on the ground doing that work.
We're visiting today with Missy Barranco. She is the executive director of Aspire ND. You can find out more at uspirend.org. We are talking about the Healthy Families Program, which was previously run under Lutheran Social Services. And after that unexpected closure at the beginning of this year, has now been running under Aspire ND. Missy, you just used the word connection or connecting a lot, which is, of course, a major part of anyone who works in this kind of family-oriented business. It's a big part of their job. And I'm curious, starting all of this during a pandemic, let's talk about how you do establish these deep interpersonal relationships if some of this has to be done electronically only.
Absolutely. So we very much embraced the virtual world immediately in the early days of the pandemic. And I think what actually was a blessing is that we are already a year into it when Lutheran Social Services closed. So we'd become very comfortable with doing video meetings and those types of things, which made it really easy to establish such as a board of directors or connect with our community because we could connect virtually without having to travel, without having to have some of those expenses. It was really inexpensive for us to be able to connect in those different ways. And people were already comfortable with those ways. So it wasn't that we were initiating it, but mm-hmm. our world has been part of that virtual world, had been for about 10 months already. And so when we asked people, could you meet with us via video? Could you connect with us? And then I also think people recognize that this is a terrible time to end services for families. Hmm. Who are really struggling. Yeah. And so people became very passionate about wanting to spread the word and make sure that we stayed around and support us. And some of that support was financially, and some of it was just continually checking in or offering to do a website for us or offering to create a logo for us or things like that, that we just had people rise up and say, hey, I have this talent. I can help do this. And I think some of that comes from whenever we're at risk of losing something or we see something at risk of being taken away, mm-hmm. that we fight for it as a community. And so it was just amazing to see each day that you know, we woke up going, okay, are we going to make it again today? And another person would connect with us or contact us, or we would meet someone and they would say, this is important and I can help in this way. Just really kept us going every day.
Has the need for your services increased during the pandemic?
I would say yes. It's hard to establish if the need has increased because of the pandemic or because we're just continuing to get the word out more and more. Mm-hmm. And so we definitely have grown. We've added 3 staff since we left Lutheran Social Services in March. And so that is, I think, a great sign and tribute to the growth as well as to the support that we have to make sure that we continue the services. So we're definitely receiving referrals. I think family stress levels are much higher and continue to be high.
Mm-hmm. What about the level of support that you get from the state?
So our Department of Human Services through the whole process was incredibly supportive. They have provided us some funding for many years and they wanted to make sure that we continued. We also received some funding that is more of a fee for service, but is directly related with the Department of Human Services and what's called Title IV-E funding that comes through federally into our state, that is preventive funds to prevent children from entering foster care. And so we'd been working with them for a couple years on that funding. And so they were very committed to doing what they could to make sure that the Healthy Families Program stayed alive in North Dakota. And so we were really lucky just to have that support in the form of different grants and, like I said, the Title IV-E funds that we're now able to access. Hmm.
You talked about doing all of this work, supporting families from the very beginning, whether they are still expecting or somewhat newly delivered or whenever the need arises on that parenting journey, with the overall goal to prevent kids having to be placed in foster care. So let's talk about what happens to kids when they are in foster care. And I'm not saying that this is exclusively and forcibly a negative event, but what are some of those main reasons why you feel it's so important to try to prevent the foster care system?
So we know that in babies immediately form attachments and bonds with their caregivers. And so the removal of that attachment and bond is traumatic for them. And there's new science that continues to come out that shows that it impacts them even before they have memory. Mm. And so when we think of it, most of us can't remember things when we were 2 months old or 4 months old. And so sometimes there was this thought that while removing children from their family at that young age, they won't remember it or it won't impact them. And now there is science that shows us that those memories, even though we can't cognitively pull them forward, they're stored in our system in ways that are hard to explain. And so you'll find children at later ages that maybe experience some of those traumatic events that are struggling with mental health and are struggling with different things that they aren't really understanding. And often we can trace that back to having traumatic events mm-hmm. in their early childhood. Of course, we want children safe, right? So we don't want children in homes where they aren't safe and there is abuse or significant neglect going on. But we also believe that it's important that we provide families the support that they may need to do differently. And sometimes that's just lack of resources or understanding or information before we move to a point of removal.
I wonder how much of that too could be in cases a lack of community, people who are ending up in rural communities and working very hard jobs and then coming home or having been home all the time with that child, and people, especially people who are not parents, like have no idea how it is. It's more than 24/7 here to parent something that is crying and needy, and you are responsible for every facet of their survival and sometimes alone.
Right. And having to make sometimes tough decisions if they are resource poor, where maybe financially things are hard, or we see a lot of families that don't have a vehicle or a vehicle that runs well. And so sometimes providing, you know, you think of the simple fact of getting groceries in the winter in North Dakota.
Right.
If sometimes you don't have a running vehicle. Right. And I mean, I think of myself as a mom and times when I had to go to the grocery store with my children and I had a car that was warm, but even just getting out of the car and walking from the store to the car and back and forth with groceries and a baby. But then you imagine not having a vehicle. And so that is something that we see often, and that creates a lot of stress. And so the stress then sometimes moves on to how they're responding to the children or able to respond. So when we think of being under high levels of stress, our responses aren't as healthy and as positive. And so we work with families a lot to help kind of normalize that that stress you're feeling is normal, but what are some things we can do to de-stress, and what are some resources we can connect them to lessen the stress? And then also helping parents understand that their responses to their child, reading their cues and communication, is so important even in these early years. So helping them to know that even though this is a baby that's 2 months old and maybe doesn't seem to know a lot, how we're responding to that baby at 2 months old or 9 months old or 2 years old is vital to their well-being as they grow.
Why did you want this organization, Aspire ND? Normally you would spell that with an A, Aspire, USPIRE. Tell us the significance of the name.
Well, there's a couple stories that go behind that. In anybody who started a business or new nonprofit or anything, and you have to register it with the state, you have to be creative a little bit because otherwise, if there's another entity that's registered that name, you have to get permission, and there's a lot of steps. And we, as I stated earlier, were moving very quickly and needed to in order to not stop services for families. So that was part of it. We knew right away we had to be unique. So we tossed around a lot of words, used the thesaurus, and the word aspire in itself, in its traditional spelling, hit home to many of us who are working on this, because we really see families, we really believe families aspire to be good parents. There's nobody that has a baby and thinks, gosh, I want to do this terribly, right? I don't want this to work out. Everybody who sees their baby for the first time is thinking, I want to be the greatest parent to this child. And so we have really good aspirations, and sometimes life just gets in the way. And so we were thinking about that and thought, what about the play on the word aspire and put US as us doing it together? And so we see it as we are doing it together with families. We're with them on their journey. We want to hear their stories and walk with them. And we're doing it with them. So it's not us doing for them. It's doing with them and supporting them so they can be strong.
Missy Barranco is the executive director of Aspire ND. You can find out more at USPIREND.org. Missy, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Main Street, Tom Ezern.
Support for Pray Public is provided by United Way of Cass Clay, bringing our community together, lifting families out of poverty, and creating a better tomorrow for all of us. When we believe united, we succeed united. Learn more at UnitedWayCassClay.org. And by Bill Dean, Realtor with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck, serving the Bismarck, Mandan, and Minot areas from homes and ranches to rental properties. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Historians turn to a number of sources to write about history, and one such account is a memoir. In today's Plainsfolk essay, historian Tom Ezern talks about the new book from Sarah Vogel, The Farmer's Lawyer, about her time defending farmers during the 1980s farm crisis.
Remember first, as you read Sarah Vogel's remarkable book, The Farmer's Lawyer, that it is a memoir. This is her story to tell, grounded by solid legal records and trial transcripts. A historian, in which I am, would like some additional context on the farm crisis of the 1980s, the perfect storm of speculation, inflation, weather, market instability, and interest rates that brought matters to a head. Such material, however, might have damaged the focus and finding of the work. The Farmer's Daughter, you see, is not about causation. It is about responsibility. Given the situation at hand, certain people were in authority to deal with it, making individual decisions about many thousands of farm families and the potential survival of their operations. Those decision-makers of the Reagan administration, Secretary of Agriculture John Block, and more specifically the administrators of the Farmers Home Administration, FMHA, galvanized by Budget Director David Stockman, disregarded individual circumstances and applied the blunt instrument of ideology to the fate of farms. Stockman imposed quotas on FMHA offices at all levels to close loan files, which meant liquidating farmers. This was in line with an ideology dictating that government was a problem to be reduced or eliminated in all aspects. Vogel implies, and as an agricultural historian, I think I would say more definitely, that this general ideological bent was reinforced by a more specific belief that the country just had too many farms, and it would be good to shed some of them, maybe most of them. Newbie litigator Vogel came home to North Dakota, was sought out by farmers needing representation, and initiated the case Coleman versus Block on behalf of 9 farmers or farm families seeking to stop foreclosure proceedings. This case morphed into a national class action suit involving heavy-hitting legal teams on both sides and resulting in victory for the farmers in February 1984, although by no means the end of farm foreclosures or farm consolidation. The case is a landmark. A few words about composition and presentation of the book. There are recurrent efforts to situate and personalize the story. Appearances of pasque flowers and harvest moons are noted. Drives across prairie landscapes are recounted. Individuals such as Vogel's father, legal sage and future state Supreme Court Justice Robert Vogel, and federal district judge Bruce M. Van Sickle are figures treated with agency and sympathy. Vogel situates herself in savvy fashion in relation to a home audience, adopting a self-deprecating tone, punctuating alternately with practicality and idealism. The work is period literature in some senses. Vogel learns of the decision of 1984 via that new marvel of technology, the fax machine, but also a cautionary tale for the 21st century. At one point, a client says to her, "See those hills? There are some bad people up there," referring to the violent organizers of the Posse Comitatus. Those people are still out there, perhaps more than ever, and the only thing that can prevent them from getting the upper hand is justice, visibly transacted. In his recent book, The Language of Cottonwoods, Clay Jenkinson posits an identity crisis for North Dakota. Sarah Vogel, in The Farmer's Lawyer, recounts and affirms the belief of her father that a healthy family farm economy was central to every aspect of life in North Dakota. Clay doubts that our agrarian foundations, the basis of our historic identity, can be restored. Sarah closes her work with a bit more optimism, but in her expressed hope to sow the seeds for a future agricultural system that is based on human needs and human values, she certainly intimates that a business-as-usual model is a dead end. Cottonwoods and Coleman notwithstanding, these matters are unsettled.
Dr. Tom Ezrin is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, CBD. But first, this news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. The state's Industrial Commission has approved the timelines and guidelines for a proposed natural gas pipeline to bring Bakken gas to central and eastern North Dakota. The legislature, in its November special session, approved using $150 million from the Federal American Recovery Plan Act to be used as seed money for the project. $10 million will go toward a pipeline to connect Grand Forks with the Viking Pipeline in western Minnesota to serve a proposed wet corn milling plant. North Dakota Pipeline Authority Director Justin Creamstead says he believes there's a lot of interest among companies for the project.
As soon as discussions started happening publicly about this potential legislation and the potential grant program, you know, over half a dozen companies have reached out and are really tracking this process. Once those documents are out and available, I think companies will already start getting to work and start working with potential customers of who would be potential shippers on this pipeline project. So it's an exciting time.
Creamstead says the goal is to have the Grand Forks part of the project up and running by 2024 and the rest of the project by 2026. North Dakota's state-owned Millen Elevator is reporting a good first quarter of fiscal 2022. Its profits for the quarter were $355,000.
That's a 2.2% increase from the $3,282,000 profit that we had in last year's first quarter.
Vance Taylor is the mill's manager.
First quarter sales were up 26% at $101,460,000. That's versus $80,226,000 last year. Mainly due to the increase in spring wheat and durum prices, and that is a new record for a quarter.
Taylor has told the state's Industrial Commission he projects the second quarter will remain strong.
We're seeing continued strong customers' demand, and this year's spring wheat and durum crops, even with the drought, have very good quality, and the flowers working very well for our customers.
North Dakota Mill and Elevator Manager Vance Taylor. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. When you look around store shelves, you might be noticing an increase in products, including CBD. And you might still be confused about what that is and where it comes from. I recently met with Troy Gultz of Plantology CBD Products at the Fargo Pride of Dakota event. Thanks for joining us today, Troy.
Thank you.
What is Plantology?
Plantology is a new CBD company in North Dakota that is from farm to pharmacy, basically. Mm-hmm. We do everything here in North Dakota, Pride of Dakota member, and we have several products that seem to be working fairly well in a medicinal situation. We've got salves, we've got some tincture oils, we've got some lip balms, we've got a brand new salve, 1,500 milligram, one of the highest that we know of, mm-hmm. of a full spectrum oil, and everything seems to be working very, very well.
What do you mean seems to be?
We've had no complaints, and we have a lot of reorders on our internet site. We've had good feedback from all the Pride of Dakota shows and a lot of return customers.
What is CBD? A lot of people think, is this weed? Is this not weed?
CBD is a cannabis plant product. It does not have very much THC in it. Usually the law requires less than 0.3%. With our full spectrum oil, we are less than 0.3% of THC. So you don't get the psychotic portion of the cannabis plant, but you get the medicinal part of the cannabis plant.
Which is what?
There's several things that it's been known to work for and that we know it works for. Nausea, weight loss, lowers blood sugar, aches and pains, immune system, digestion, joints, bone health, organ function. Mentally, it's a heck of a good sleep aid, anxiety, headaches, reduces stress, depression, just general well-being. And then medicinally, it aids in the recovery on anything that has inflammation in the body. It's known to be a huge inflammation reducer. Cognitive function, cancer symptoms, multiple sclerosis, arthritis, eczema, psoriasis. We hear stories upon stories upon stories of all kinds of different things that it helps people with.
How long has the research been out on CBD?
Well, I think in other countries, CBD has been used for quite some time. It's fairly new in the United States, and it's very new to North Dakota. But from what we're hearing and what we're seeing and most of the research out there, which there isn't a lot, very good results.
Why was it slow to come to North Dakota?
Well, I guess we were one of the first licenses in North Dakota plantology, so we grew it farm to pharmacy, and the governor only signed the bill that allowed us to raise CBD, I believe, in 2019. So before that, CBD wasn't allowed in the state of North Dakota. So until we've got the legislation caught up with some of the rest of the states, and now most of the states, I think all of the states, or 48 out of the 50 states, CBD is legal.
So have you been working with the legislature or just waiting for them?
We've worked with some of the parts of the Ag Department in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. Well, our product is now at retail. We're concentrating on building our business and getting it out to the public to help everybody with whatever medicinal issue they have or whatever problem they have. If we have something that works for them, we try to get it out to them.
Are you doing the farming? Are you growing the hemp?
Yes, we grew everything. We grew it. We hung it to dry. We actually hand shucked it, and then we actually extricate it and formulate it and bottle it. We extricate the oil with CO2 extrication.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, we squeeze the product, get the oil out. And, of course, there's testing and there's all kinds of things that go on. But once you get the oil out of the cannabis and you know the purity of the oil, then you can formulate a formulation that has been known to work well. We've also added other things to our salves, other oils. Everything is organically grown. Everything is USDA registered organic that we add to the product. Mm. So we try to keep the product safe. We also test thoroughly throughout the process from the beginning all the way to the end to make sure there's no pesticides, no herbicides, no heavy metals, nothing bad in the product that's going to hurt anybody.
Well, let's talk about that word organic, because I think a lot of people think of that sort of crunchy granola hippie lady, and I don't mean any offense by this, but you're a very normal looking dude.
Okay.
Why was it important to you to have that organic option?
Well, I think people are starting to go more that way. You know, you see the natural grocery stores and stuff, mm-hmm. and it's just something that people think is important to their health. So we wanted to do it in an organic way, so there was no pesticides, no herbicides sprayed on the product, and so that nobody has to worry about that. We didn't want to eliminate that part of our customer base.
What is the shelf life once it is extracted?
I don't know if I can give you an absolutely accurate shelf life, because I don't know that anybody knows. But it seems to be just fine. We keep it in a refrigerated place. It seems to last. Mm-hmm. When we retest it, everything tests the same. Everything that goes out in any of our bottles is retested once it's formulated and once it goes into the bottle.
Hmm.
So we're going to know if there's any issues with that product. The actual batch ID is on the bottle. Our QR reader is on the bottle, so anybody can QR read it. It's going to give them exactly what's in it for cannabinoids, exactly what's in it for THC. And we have tests available for that batch at any given time.
What's the Hemposium?
When hemp started to come into North Dakota, and being we were one of the first growers in North Dakota to grow CBD hemp, our first year growing, we had a lot of knowledge. We had given a lot of seminars, and so we put on our own seminar, which was considered the Hemposium.
Mm.
And we put that on in Leonard, North Dakota, took everybody out to the fields, showed them around the field, showed them about a cannabis plant, tried to educate them on how to farm a cannabis plant, and just got them up to there was a lot of farmers looking at doing it, so we got them up, and that was what was considered our symposium. We brought in a lot of lead speakers, myself, several other speakers, just to educate the general farming population and the community about CBD and about how to grow hemp.
So geared very much at the producers. This wasn't something that you needed to get the legislators to come in and learn about the process.
No, it was it was done by Plantology for the producers and the people who were interested in CBD products and actually growing hemp.
What piqued your interest?
I had a couple of parents that died of cancer. Mm-hmm. Cannabis plant seemed to be something that was up and coming to help with some of the cancer symptoms, some of the cancer research, so that's kind of what piqued our interest.
In the few years of doing the hemposiums and then the growing and then being on the market, have you noticed that you have to give the same level of education every year still?
I think more people are hearing about CBD. You got the people that are a little bit nervous about CBD. You got the people who have heard about it and tried it and had good results. You got people who have tried it that maybe didn't get as good a results, but you know, that's based off of, you know, what product did they buy, how many milligrams were they using. And so we've tried to base our stuff off of some of the highest milligrams of cannabinoids in the industry so that we can get the most medicinal value out of the product. And some people are at lower values, and maybe they aren't, those people aren't seeing those medicinal values. But I mean, the CBD industry is growing. Obviously COVID slowed things down like it slowed everything down, but it's growing. We seem to have more response every time we get out with the public, and so we just keep educating, keep people learning more about CBD, keep people trying it. And I think as the future gets brighter for CBD, people are going to be using it more. People are going to understand that it has a great natural medicinal value.
When you talk about wanting to be high on the cannabinoid levels and then using a word like natural, do you have to warn some people, though, that even things like water, too much water, can be bad, even though it's natural? How do you talk to people about just not over-relying on something being natural, meaning you can just take as much as you absolutely want?
We recommend a dose on the bottle, and it says right on the bottle, on our bottles, on our tinctures, that it's you need to take it as needed. So it's something that each person's body may respond a little bit differently, so they may have to adjust that as they see how their body responds.
How important is a show like Pride of Dakota to what you do?
I think it's excellent in getting the word out. You know, you're getting a lot of people to see your product. Pride of Dakota has been very easy to work with. I know the agricultural department's pretty proud of what they've done with the Pride of Dakota, and we're happy to be part of it.
And are you hoping to be the next Dots Pretzels? $1.2 billion sale, something like that?
Well, that'd be great, yes. We got plenty of product on hand and plenty of product for everybody, so the future should be good in CBD in North Dakota.
Well, thanks so much for your time today, Troy.
All right, thank you.
That was Troy Galt of Plantology CBD. You can find out more at PlantologyInc.com. The Bismarck Pride of Dakota show is this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Dakota Datebook is next.
Eat Your Heartland Out, a show all about the food and culture of the American Midwest. I'm Capri Cafaro. We are having a spirited conversation about spirits. Our first stop is a distillery in Minnesota that is fueled by its founder's punk rock ethos. Then it's on to an Illinois farm committed to producing whiskey with a grain-to-glass approach. Grab a glass and get ready to learn how Midwestern craft distilleries bring you the perfect pour.
Eat Your Heartland Out, coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck and dedicated to producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind projects in North and South Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 30th. Life was not easy at the Fort Clark Fur Trading Post back in the 1830s. The fort was located on the Missouri River near present-day Washburn, and it was a major economic center. The post manager, Francis Chardon, kept a journal describing the cold weather, the fur trade, tribal activities, and the devastating smallpox epidemic. He also kept a regular tally of how many rats he had killed. Norway rats arrived in the New World in the 18th century and became terrible pests. They infested the fort and native villages. Rats burrowed into and ate stores of Indian corn. They gnawed through the fort's wooden floorboards and pickets. They also reproduced at a prolific rate. Artist George Catlin wrote that the Hidatsas were initially grateful for the rats because they preyed upon annoying deer mice, but the villagers were horrified when they saw the destruction the rats caused. German Prince Maximilian of Wied wintered at the fort from 1833 to 1834 and wrote that the rats were so troublesome and numerous that one could not keep any supply safe from them. He also observed that the fort's single tame cat did nothing to help to lessen the tremendous plague of rats. The horde of rats could eat 5 bushels of corn in a day. Maximilian wrote that the rats gnawed holes in the floorboards so we could enjoy their visits. His party put their tame fox in the attic to keep down the rats. Post manager Chardon recorded that rat kills could number in the dozens for a single day. One day in 1835, Chardon wrote, "Last night, the rats were very thick. We killed 18. On one day in 1836, he killed 34. On this date in 1837, Chardon wrote that he killed 268 rats in the month of November, bringing his total to more than 2,200. But that wasn't the end. After 5 years, Chardon had recorded more than 3,700 dead rats. In one correspondence, he wrote, "You have no idea of the quantity of rats that are at this place." The rats infested the fort as late as 1858, and archaeologists found their remains aplenty during excavations in 2001. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
The Supreme Court is set to hear arguments in a Mississippi case that could end up reversing Roe v. Wade and later decisions declaring that a person has a constitutional right to terminate a pregnancy.
The very essence of a constitutional right is that it is not up to the legislatures. It's a right that we all have that legislatures cannot take away from us.
Well, the court's new conservative majority overturned nearly 50 years of precedent. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. to 9 central here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Indigenous meditation practices. And coming up now, All Things Considered.